As we continue to study the Jewish people in prophecy, it becomes very evident that there's many things going on in the lives of these Jewish people down through history that the Lord is using for a special purpose. We've talked about the covenants David just talked about, and that's a very interesting thought that he had, the Mosaic covenant being actually fulfilled at the end of the tribulation period. I like that. And it was interesting to me that he brought that up. But we see how God's hand is working. And the punishment and the reward type of situation is so evident. As we come now to this next subject, which we're going to be dealing with, and it's going to be talking about the worldwide distribution or dispersion of the Jewish people in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 28. We're going to see how God has done that a number of times in the past. And as we look at history, understanding that he has done that in the past and how many times the scriptures tell us he will be doing that, it helps us then to move onto an understanding of where we are in God's time and what he is doing. In the Hebrew language, the word diaspora is talking about the Jewish people that are dispersed to some place in the world. The word aliyah is meaning that they are returning to the land. Aliyah, referring back to the 23rd chapter of the book of Exodus, is where the Lord commands that each male Jew three times a year is to make his way to Jerusalem. Aliyah, technically interpreted, means go up to Jerusalem. And every male in the Jewish world was to three times a year at the pilgrim feast make their way into Jerusalem. The first pilgrim feast was Passover. The second one was Pentecost. And the third one was Tabernacles. And so you have the first and the fourth and the last of the feast when the Jewish males were to make Aliyah to go up to Jerusalem. That's why you saw at the time of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ the expansion of the population of the city of Jerusalem, because it was Passover and these Jews were coming into Jerusalem keeping or making Aliyah. And then on the day of Pentecost, it says in Acts chapter 2 and verse 5, there were Jews from every nation of the world gathered at Jerusalem for the feast of Pentecost. That's why the Ethiopian eunuch had come from Ethiopia into Jerusalem, the Feast of Pentecost. And then at Tabernacles, they have the Feast of Tabernacles in Israel, and that's when a time the Jews and Christians from all over the world come to Jerusalem to celebrate, because Zechariah chapter 14 tells us that even in the millennial kingdom, we're going to make Aliyah. The entire world will come up to Jerusalem at the Feast of Tabernacles. Tabernacles, of course, is the feast that's fulfilled, and all of the Jewish feasts have not only a historic background, but they have a prophetic significance as well. And in that Feast of Tabernacles, it's celebrating the kingdom period. That's why when Peter was on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus Christ and he saw Moses and Elijah and Jesus in their resurrected, glorified bodies, in the kingdom body, he made the statement, let's put up three tabernacles. That wasn't for the purpose of putting up a statue for those three men, but the Feast of Tabernacles is where they put up a sukkah, S-U-C-C-A, and a sukkah is a thatched hut. They would take four poles and then put the branches of four different species of trees. That's how they lived in the wandering in the wilderness. It was a transportable habitation for them. They could carry the four poles and then they'd find some limbs of trees and put them over the top to protect them from the sun and the elements of the weather. And so they build a sukkah every Feast of Tabernacles in Israel. The people, most of the Jewish people in Jerusalem, for example, they have outside of their kitchen a little patio, and so the mother can be able to serve because they build the sukkah up there. The children will probably play all day in the sukkah. The families will have their meals in the sukkah. The husband might invite a guest over to sit in the sukkah. They may even stay in the sukkah all night. Some just leave the room, but they sit near the kitchen so she can make the meals. And they celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, people from all over the world to come, especially the Christians, and they're using that as a vehicle of witnessing to the Jews, standing with them we're going to do it for eternity, we might as well start doing it now. And that's their whole purpose behind it. And so Aliyah is to go up to Jerusalem, but it's now been made applicable for returning to the land. Jews, from wherever they have gone, they will make Aliyah. In other words, there have been three diasporas, and there's been two Aliyahs, and in the time that we are living now, the third Aliyah is in the process of being fulfilled. The first Aliyah took place in the book of Joshua, following the diaspora of the Jewish people out of the land for 400 years, which Abraham was told would happen. Let's look at these three departures, or the diasporas of the Jewish people, and then the Aliyahs, because as we look at this, we see how history has unfolded, the purposes God had for these departures and returns, and then what he's doing in the end times. Go to Genesis chapter 46 with me, if you will, and remember when I was going through quickly our look at the history of the Jewish people, we looked briefly at Genesis chapter 46. It's very interesting to note that Abraham went into Egypt in a sojourn because of famine in the land. Then God, in the 26th chapter of the book of Genesis, tells Isaac not to go into Egypt. But we come now to Jacob, the third of the patriarchs, and because of the famine in the land and the fact that his son Joseph had already gone into Egypt and became a very prominent leader in Egypt, that God then is going to give permission for Jacob to go into the land. Verse 1 of chapter 46, and Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba, and he offered sacrifices unto God his father, unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spake unto Israel, that's Jacob, in the visions of the night, and he said, Jacob, Jacob, and he said, here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. And I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again. Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. And Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel, Jacob, carried Jacob, their father, and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And you know the story of Joseph. I'm not going to rehearse all of that, which would be from chapter 37 through chapter 45 rather, of the book of Genesis. Now look at verse 6. And they took their cattle and their goods, which they had gotten in the land of Canaan, and they came into Egypt, Jacob and all of his seed with him. We know that how many people that was, according to verse 27, and the sons of Joseph, which were born in Egypt, were two souls, and all the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 70. 70 of the members of the family of Jacob will enter into Egypt. Now, we know the sojourn is going to be over 400 years. There's some times that people are concerned about the different numbers, because when God told Abraham they would go into this foreign land, it was 400 years they would be there. In the book of Exodus, when we see them coming out, it was 430 years they had been there. And so those numbers are kind of a concern for a contradiction. Well, what you have to look at is Joseph had gone into the land, and he was there for approximately 30 years before Jacob goes in the land. So Jacob's family was there in the land, which was the commitment that God made, or the statement that God made to Abraham. So they were truly in 430 years. Both are correct. Jacob went in for a 400-year period of time, but one key member of his family was in there for a 30-year period before he ever started. That destroys the contradiction. That's a sidebar. My point is that they go into the Egyptian bondage. They go into the diaspora. They are dispersed from the land. God has given them this land. The Abrahamic covenant is absolute. The land has been given to them. God brings Abraham from Ur of the Chaldees to give him this land. And then Jacob is going to be leaving the land. Now, this time, it's not for punishment necessarily, but it's for the formation. Why did he say, I'm going to take you in there? To develop a nation inside this land. And when they go into the land, they're going to come back out of the land as well. In the book of Exodus, we see that this is recorded. Go with me to chapter 12 and verse 37 of Exodus. And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramesh to Sukkoth, about 600,000 on foot that were men beside the children. And of course, the women. Can't have children without the women. 600,000 men. That would mean you probably have about 600,000 women. That's 1.2 million. And if you have 600,000 men and 600,000 women, you probably got at least, 800,000 children. And so 2 million of them come out. 70 go in, the nation is formed, and 2 million of them come out. The return into the promised land starts with the Exodus. That's chapter 12 of the book of Exodus. And the purpose is to bring them out of this Egyptian bondage into the promised land. Go to Joshua in chapters 1, 2, and 3. We see how they are going to now make their aliyah and come back into the land. So the first departure was when they go into Egypt. The first return is when they're going to come back out of the wanderings in the wilderness, ultimately out of Egypt, and come back into the land. Chapter 3 of the book of Joshua. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from Shittim and came to Jordan. They'd been bivouacked there in Shittim, which is on the eastern shore of the Jordan River. When we take tours over in that part of the country, go by that location. They were preparing themselves to cross over the Jordan River into the promised land. They had the Ark of the Covenant. They had the priests go down, stand in the Jordan. It dried up for about 5 miles. It was overrunning its banks. If you've ever seen the Jordan River today, it's not much, but at that time it was the flood season, overflowing its banks, and for at least a 5 mile area they crossed over when the river dried up, and they come back into the promised land. So this is Joshua recording the return of the Jewish people out of the Egyptian bondage back into the promised land. Of course, then they go forth to capture all of the land that God has given to them, this promised land. By the way, when they came in, remember both David and I mentioned the fact that when they came in, everybody had died who came out. Of those 2 million who came out of the Egyptian bondage in Exodus chapter 12, all of them except two, and that would be Joshua and Caleb, died. And the numbers have been suggested by somebody, 69 deaths per day of those people that would not be able to go into the promised land because of unbelief. Many were born, of course, in the wanderings over that 40-year period of time, and they would go in. What's interesting, when they went in, none of the men had been circumcised. So a circumcision meeting took place, chapter 5. At Gilgal. That must have been a tough time for all those old guys going into the promised land, but it was an interesting situation that happens here. And they had a Passover. Look at verse 10. And the children of Israel, chapter 5, verse 10 of Joshua, the children of Israel encamped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at the evening of the plains of Jericho. They'd actually supposed to have observed the Passover on a yearly basis, but they only observed it 3 times from the beginning. The first time they observed it is when they, that night that they left. The second Passover they had was a year later when they are standing at the foot of Mount Sinai, and they have the Passover at that point in time. And then the third time, and the reason they didn't have it, they had the lambs that would be with us, but and they could have slaughtered the lamb, but they never had enough time in one location to get enough wheat to make the unleavened bread. You have to have 3 items for the Passover: the unleavened bread, the lamb, and the bitter herbs. Those are the only 3 requirements in the scriptures. And so they weren't able to do that. But when they come into the promised land, they make aliyah, they immigrate back into the land, they observed the Passover, and a circumcision service took place. And so this is the first departure and the first return of the Jewish people. The second departure begins, and it has three parts to it, with Daniel and his three Hebrew buddies, chapter 1 of the book of Daniel, being taken into the Babylonian captivity. Now let me show you why they're taken into the Babylonian captivity. You're still in the Torah. Go to the book of Leviticus, chapter 25. The book of Leviticus, chapter 25. Chapter 25 in Leviticus is talking about what God wants the people to do with the land. He has given this land. Remember, he gave the land to the Jewish people. And so he has a plan that he wants them to follow. Verse 21 of chapter 25. Then I will command my blessing upon you in the sixth year, and it will bring forth fruit for 3 years. And ye shall sow the eighth year and eat yet the old fruit until the ninth year, until her fruits come in, and ye shall eat of the old store. What he's talking about here is that every seventh year the land is to get a sabbatical. You can grow the crops and harvest the crops for 6 years. But in the seventh year, you are not to even till the land. You are to let the land rest. Give it a sabbatical. Now that's his command, and I'll tell you why he has the right to do it. But that is the case. And he said, now look, I'm going to prosper you in the sixth year. It'll last you into the seventh and through the seventh year, into the eighth year, and until the ninth year, you can bring your crops back in. Notice why he had the right to do this. Verse 23, the land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, for ye are strangers and sojourners with me. The reason God can tell the Jewish people what to do with the land, it's his land, does not belong to Israel, does not belong to the Palestinians, does not belong to the United States, does not belong to the United Nations, does not belong to the European Union. It's God's land. And he only makes the Jewish people sojourners, caretakers of the land. It's his land. He's going to give it to them. He has the right to say. No negotiations needs to go on. It's God's land. He's given them to it, given it to them, and he's to dictate what's going to happen. That's why he has the right to tell them, rest this land every 7 years. Give it a sabbatical, give it a Shabbat, and then, of course, in the Jubilee, which would be after 7 Sabbaths, 49 years, in the next year, the 50th year, the Jubilee, you're supposed to return everything that all your debts are supposed to be taken care of. I like that Jubilee idea. I wish we could institute that. I'd like to apply some of Judaism to what we're doing today. But that's all talked about here. It's really nothing to do with the diaspora or the Aliyah. But this is why God has the authority. It's his land. He can do with it what he wants to. Now, because the Jews failed to give it the sabbatical, God is now, in the second departure, or the second diaspora, going to take the Jews out of the land for the purpose of giving it the sabbatical. We read in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 25 and verse 9, and 29:10, that God is going to rest that land for a 70-year period of time. That thus then gives us the information 70 times 7, 490. It was 490 years that the Jewish people were disobedient to God. We come back now around to 605 BC when Nebuchadnezzar, let me tell you how this all came about, and God's going to use human government. That's a principle. We'll look at it in Revelation in just a moment. But God is going to use human government to accomplish his will. Let me tell you what was going on. What was happening at the time that Daniel was taken into the Babylonian captivity was that the Egyptians had come through the land bridge of Israel. They had gone north. They go up to Assyria. They're going to join with the Assyrians to try to fight the Babylonians. Meanwhile, Nebuchadnezzar, who is the crown prince, he's not the king of Babylon, he's the crown prince, he comes across the north, and he's going to deal with the Assyrians. He defeats the Assyrians, and then he starts driving the Egyptians back through that land bridge of Israel into Africa, northern Africa, into Egypt itself. As he's in the process of driving the Egyptians back into Egypt, he hears word that his father, the king of Babylon, has died, and he is the crown prince, has been appointed king. And so he starts up the Via Maris. You got that map out there? Let me just show them here. Where's anybody have a? I haven't found my little clicker. Anybody got one? Okay, the light's not really that good. Here's the Dead Sea right here. Here's the Sea of Galilee. Here's Babylon right over here, where this little castle is right here. This is Babylon. This would be the Euphrates River. This would be the Tigris River. This would be the Persian Gulf, the lower sea right now. The Mediterranean Sea, the greater sea over here. This is Canaan right here, or the land of Israel. This is the Sea of Galilee. This is the Dead Sea. Down here would then be Egypt, the Sinai Desert, and Egypt. Up here would be Lebanon going up through the Euphrates, and then you got Syria, and then you got Jordan that comes down here. You have Saudi Arabia. And so that's how it's all laid out. What happens is, as Nebuchadnezzar leaves Babylon, he goes up, defeats the Assyrians, pushes the Egyptians, after he defeats the Assyrians, pushes the Egyptians back here into Egypt. He hears word that his father has died, and now he's the king. So he starts up the Via Maris. This is the way of the sea, Via Maris, the way of the sea. He comes out to about where Jerusalem is, and he cuts across because the direct line back to Babylon would be across the desert. Remember, Abraham went up over the Fertile Crescent and down. But Nebuchadnezzar has to get back. And as he comes through Jerusalem, Daniel chapter 1, he sees a strange worship going on in a temple. They're offering sacrifices. He's never seen anything like this. And so he decides he needs to take some hostages, get that phrase, hostages back into Babylon with him and learn, because he's not going to rule all of this world. He's going to be the ruler of the world, and he needs to know what's going on. And so he comes down there. He takes Daniel and his three Hebrew buddies. You mean Ananias, Azariah, and Mishael, which is their godly names. If you want to use ungodly names, that's all right with me. But anyway, he takes them back into Babylon. He trains them up. That's 605 B.C. In 597 B.C., he comes back again, the second wave going into Jerusalem. This time, they take Ezekiel and about 10,000 of the Jewish people. This is Ezekiel chapter 1, 2, and 3, where he takes them over into Tel Aviv. Now, not Tel Aviv of Israel, but Tel Aviv, which is on a tributary of the Euphrates River, a place of the name of the place where they take him. So they take 10,000, that's 597 B.C., that's the second wave. The third wave, he comes back in, he destroys the city, he devastates the temple, and he takes all those remaining Jews that are not killed in that attack back into Babylon. And that now then becomes the second diaspora, the second time that the Jews go out of the land. This time, it's because of their disobedience. They did not give the land a sabbatical. They did not rest it, so they're going to go out of the land. The Bible, remember, in Jeremiah prophesied that would happen. Go to 2 Chronicles chapter 3. Let me just show you. We looked at it before. Let me show you again what the text says. 2 Chronicles chapter 36. Excuse me. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 7. Nebuchadnezzar also carried all the vessels of the house of the Lord to Babylon and put them in his temple in Babylon. When he destroyed the temple, he took all the vessels. You remember his grandson, Belshazzar, fifth chapter of the book of Daniel, is going to say, hey, remember those implements that my granddaddy brought out? Go get them, fill them up with wine. He was talking about the Mizrach. Look up here just a moment. The Mizrach is a pitcher-shaped item made out of pure gold and pure silver. It doesn't have a base. It has a point on it and it has a handle on it. That's what they would put the sacrificial blood in, and the priests would carry it around. The reason there's no base, the priest couldn't set it down, or the blood would coagulate. But they would take the blood from the sacrificed animals, go and pour it on the altar. That was the whole purpose. Or ultimately, at the day of Yom Kippur, they would use the Mizrach to take it into the Holy of Holies and pour the blood on the mercy seat. Well, that's what they took in. They didn't take the Ark of the Covenant because the Ark of the Covenant, chapter 35, verse 3, had been hidden underneath the location where King Solomon had prepared a secret, secluded hiding place to take care of the Ark of the Covenant. But he's going to take the rest of the implements into his temple over there in Babylon. Now notice what happens in verse 18. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and his princes, all of these were brought into Babylon. And they burned the house of God, and break down the wall of Jerusalem, and burned all the palaces thereof with fire, and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away into Babylon. All those that did not die were carried away into Babylon. By the way, if you remember a prophecy, again, everything that's happening in Jewish history is setting the stage for Bible prophecy to be fulfilled or be the fulfillment of it. In the fifth chapter of the book of Ezekiel, it talks about Ezekiel, a prophet to his people, cutting his hair off of his head, off of his beard. He puts it in three parts. And then he burns one part of it, he stabs one part of it, and he throws another part in the air. That's a prophecy of what was going to happen when Nebuchadnezzar came in. What happens is when the army comes in on this third wave, he kills a third of the people. A third of the people are burned up when they burn the city and the temple, and a third are taken into the Babylonian captivity. And so all of these are taken into the Babylonian captivity. Now notice what it says here in verse 21. To fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbath, for as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. And so for 490 years, they had not observed the Sabbath of the land, and God's going to take them out. Isn't that a wonderful principle? I mean, it's a principle that's been applicable in my life. God tells me to do something, I don't do it, so he does it himself for me. Well, that happens to Israel, and remember, they're an example. What did I tell you one of their four purposes was? To give testimony of the blessing received when you're obedient to a true, perfect, and holy God. The reverse of that is to give testimony of the chastisement you're going to receive when you're not obedient to a true, perfect, and holy God. And this is the purpose now for the second diaspora, the taking of the Jewish people into Babylon. There is going to be a return of these Jewish people, and it's found across the page from 2 Chronicles chapter 36 in the book of Ezra. God is going to raise up this man that Isaiah prophesied would come to power and allow the Jews to return to the land. So this would be the second return. Chapter 1 of Ezra, verse 2. Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, and by the way, that's who Isaiah named in the 44th chapter of the book of Isaiah. Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the world. He's now the most powerful leader in all of the world, and he hath charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Not only to allow the Jews to return, but he's going to allow them to return and build a temple. In fact, he's going to contribute to the building of that temple as you study the Word of God here. Chapter 2 of the book of Ezra is then the record of how that is going to take place. God is going to allow the Jewish people to return under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua. Zerubbabel would be the political leader, Joshua the spiritual leader. They would go back into the land. The purpose of returning to the land, number one, but number two, to build that temple. And the record is then that in the first six chapters, they ultimately get around to building the temple, especially with the encouragement of Haggai and Zechariah. I love those two prophecies. I love those two prophets. They're unbelievable. One of them was really suave and debonair and good-looking. The other one is an old, crusty old man, in-your-face kind of guy. You know, like me and David. David would be Zechariah, the suave, good-looking one, and I'd be the crusty old man Haggai. Zechariah would try to pleasantly say to them, you got to build a temple, Haggai. Get the temple built! What's wrong with you Jews? But that's an exciting part of how it all came together. They finally built the temple. They left Babylon in 539 B.C. That was the fall of the Babylonian Empire. Took them 25 years to build the temple. They didn't get the temple built until about 515 B.C. Have a dedicatory service here in chapter 6 of that temple that has been built. But that's the second return. That's the second aliyah. They come out of the land, and 70 years later, they go back into the land. And again, that was what Daniel was reading in chapter 9 and verse 2 when he was reading that at 85 years of age, he'd been out of the land for 70 years, came out when he was 15. Hey, that makes him 85. And he was able to determine where he was in God's time because of his study of Bible prophecy. So that's the second departure and the second return. Go with me to the book of Matthew, if you will, chapter 24. And I want to look with you at the third departure of the Jewish people and what God is doing with them to bring them in line with what he wants to have them do. Let me just set the scene for you in the book of Matthew chapter 24. It's Monday afternoon of Passion Week. On Saturday, the triumphal entry had taken place. On Sunday, nobody even winced when I said that. There's no such thing as Palm Sunday. It's Palm Saturday. It took place on Saturday. On Sunday, he goes into the temple and throws the money changers out. That's why I know that it wasn't Sunday when he went down. Because if he'd have gone down on Sunday, he'd have thrown the money changers out if they'd have been there. But he went down on Saturday and they weren't there because that's the Sabbath. And they didn't work on the Sabbath. They worked on the first workday of the Jewish week, which was Sunday. Now, Monday. And Monday, he goes up. First day he went down as a potentate. Second day he goes down as the priest after the order of Melchizedek. The third day he goes down as the prophet. He's going to teach. And he's teaching there on the Temple Mount. As he's finished his teaching, he's going to return back to Bethany where he's staying with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. As he walked away from the temple, I mean, this temple was 21 stories high, covered with pure gold. On the Jerusalem skyline, it was majestic. The rabbi said, if you'd never seen Herod's temple, you'd never seen a beautiful building. It was simply unbelievable. So he starts walking away from the temple, and almost under his breath, he makes the statement, there's not going to be a stone upon a stone on this building. Oh, John and Peter. I can just hear old Peter. Peter said to John, John, did you hear what he said? Not a stone upon a stone. What's he talking about? Herod was 46 years building this temple. There's not going to be a stone upon a stone. What's wrong? They make their way across the Kidron Valley. They come up to the peak of the Mount of Olives. And Jesus sits down. That's the customary position for a rabbi to teach. So he sits down. And they come rushing to him, the disciples who had just heard this and been with him for all of these years. And they ask him three questions. When is that going to happen? When is there not going to be a stone upon a stone? Second question in Matthew 24, can you give us some signs of your coming? Now, it's not the rapture of the church, because remember, the church is not in existence, and Matthew 24 doesn't mention the rapture. It's talking about the second coming. Give us some signs. And the third thing they ask him, when is the new age coming? In other words, when is the kingdom going to be set up? You promised us a kingdom. You've refused it now. You're going to the cross. When is the kingdom going to be set up? In Matthew 24, he deals with the second question. The second question is, give us some signs. And by the way, that's another indication the rapture is not here. As Christians, we're not looking for signs. We're listening for a sound. And so that's the signs. The Bible says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22, the Jews require a sign. So he gives them some signs. But there are three parallel passages of the Olivet Discourse, which is what Jesus is giving them here. That's Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. In Mark 13 and Luke 21, he does respond to that first question, when is this going to happen? When is there not going to be a stone upon a stone on this building? When will the temple be destroyed? He gives them some signs. And go to Luke chapter 21 with me, if you will. And let me just point out a couple of those signs. Now, also in Luke chapter 21, he gives them the signs of the second coming, but he brings some other information to them as well. He talks about, and look at verse 5, and he spake unto them about the temple, how it was adorned with godly stones and gifts, and this temple's not going to be there. And they ask him, saying, Master, when shall these things be, and what signs shall be be when these things shall come to pass? And he said, take heed that you be not deceived. Now that's the answer to the question of when are you going to come again? And he continues on, but look at verse 12. But before all of these things, and by the way, what he has given up to verse 11 in Luke 21 is the same parallel statements he made over in Matthew 24. It's just another reporter of recording history here as to what took place. And then he says, Luke is recording this, but before all of these, look, they shall lie in their hands on you and persecute you and deliver you up to the synagogues and into the prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for all of my name's sake, and it shall turn to you for a testimony. Settle it therefore in your hearts, not to meditate before what your answer shall be. Here's where he's going to promise to give them the wisdom, the words that they're going to need. And notice here in verse 20, and when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee unto the mountains. This is not at the at the end of the tribulation period. This is at the time of before 70 AD when the temple is destroyed and they flee for the mountains. They probably went to Masada, the location that is on the Dead Sea, one of Herod's palaces, a fortress palace, and they run away from Jerusalem to sustain life. Now the armies will gather around. Well, what armies are those? Those are the Roman armies led by General Titus. I'm reading a great book. I would recommend it to you. It's entitled God's Goal, and it's a man, Sean Kingsley, has written it. He's an archaeologist, an adventurer, he's an historian, but he's in search of the temple treasures and where they all are today. But what I like about it so much, that's kind of exciting, but what I like about it is he rehearses the history of what happened, and he gave me insight that I'd never seen before. Vespasian, who was the emperor at that time, had been the proconsul of Israel. He was the man in charge, like Pontius Pilate. He was that man in charge years earlier. He was then selected. He came from a really dead background. He wasn't from out of the elite or intelligentsia or anything. He was a cattle breeder. They called him the Mueller because he raised mules for the army to travel. But ultimately, they choose him to be the Roman emperor. His son is General Titus. And if you remember all that had been going on, Rome and the Roman Empire was just about at its lowest time in all of history. They had depleted all of their treasures. And so General Titus and his father, Vespasian, who's now been appointed as the emperor of Rome, meet in Caesarea. And the emperor tells his son, I want you to go back to Jerusalem, destroy that temple, bring the temple treasures, just like Nebuchadnezzar had done, into Rome. If you've ever seen the relief on the Arch of Titus in Rome, you know what the Arch of Titus is? The Arch of Titus is a tangible monument to the fulfillment of Bible prophecy. Because after General Titus followed the command of his father, the emperor of Rome, and destroyed the temple, devastated the city, he dispersed the Jews to the four corners of the earth. That's what Deuteronomy 28 said would happen. If you're not obedient to me, I will disperse you to the four corners of the earth. I will make your life miserable. Well, on the Arch of Titus, on a relief, there are the Roman soldiers carrying the table of showbread, the menorah, and two silver trumpets back into Rome. And God is dispersing the Jews to the four corners of the earth in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. And he's using these leaders. As he used Nebuchadnezzar, now he is using Vespasian and General Titus. Titus would become an emperor, and of course his family, the Flavius family, became major players in the Roman Empire, basically almost to the end of the 476, in the year 476, when the empire kind of drifted into oblivion. But it's happening right here. Look what it says. Have you got Luke still open? This is where it's talking about it. Josephus, the famous Jewish historian, wrote much of the history about it. But look here in verse 24. Jesus has said it was going to happen in almost 40 years to the day that Jesus said it's going to happen. Look at verse 24, Luke 21. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive unto all nations. The fulfillment of Deuteronomy 28, they're going to be led away. Oh, by the way, look at the rest of that verse. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now, there's a very important phrase in Bible prophecy, the times of the Gentiles. The times of the Gentiles is basically a period of time between when Daniel was taken in 605 B.C. into the Babylonian captivity all the way to the return of Jesus Christ when he comes back the second time. This is a fulfillment of Daniel chapter 2. What did Daniel 2 said? It was the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. The man with a head of gold, arms and chest of silver, and belly and thighs of brass, legs of iron, 10 toes of iron and clay. Stone comes and hits that image of the man, bursting in pieces like the summer wind in the threshing floor. It blows those away, and that stone becomes a mighty mountain. And then Daniel said, O Nebuchadnezzar, thou art the head of gold. And he's giving them the Gentile world powers in chapter 2. The Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Grecian Empire, the Roman Empire, the 10 toes of iron and clay. That would be the revived Roman Empire. The stone is Jesus Christ, and that mountain is his kingdom. Okay, so the times of the Gentiles will be fulfilled. That's the prophecy given in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 7, given to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2. Chapter 7 is given to Daniel. And it'll go on the times of the Gentiles until Jesus Christ comes back. And so he's making his statement, Jerusalem shall be trodden down until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled by the Gentiles. Hello? May I ask you what's going on right now? We got a Gentile sitting in the White House in Washington, D.C., telling the Prime Minister of Israel, you can't build in Jerusalem. You see, the times of the Gentiles, listen to a simple definition, any time when the Jews and Jerusalem are under the control of Gentiles. That's the times of the Gentiles. That's today. Who controls the Temple Mount, the most sacred piece of real estate in all of creation? The Islamic Waqf, a Islamic trust. They are the custodians. Why? I thought they got Jerusalem back June 7, 1967. They did. It was reunited. But then that one-eyed, patched-eyed minister of defense, Moshe Dayan, said, hey, I know how we can appease these enemies of ours. Let's give them the Temple Mount. Stupidity. You don't appease a Muslim with giving him some. You appease a Muslim with this. And if you don't believe it, just ask any Muslim leader. They know how to do what needs to be done. It's us idiots out here that don't know how to do what's to be done. And so they give the custodial responsibilities. Who controls goes up on the Temple Mount and doesn't go up in the Temple Mount? The Muslims. It's not anything. It's key to the Judaism. It's key to Christianity. The Muslims should have nothing to do with it, but they're the ones controlling it. They're the Gentiles that are controlling. What did he say? Jerusalem's to be trodden down to the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And that's what's going to happen. But the Jews were dispersed. They're out of there. That's the third diaspora. We'll study it in another session, the return of the Jews. And I give you this bit of information. They've already started returning. They're on their way back in. I mean, there are 12 million Jews on the face of the earth today. There's 5,750,000 Jews in Jerusalem. As of last Thursday, when they gave us the statistics, 5,750,000 Jews back in the land. There's more Jews in the land of Israel than any other location. There's only 5.3 million Jews in the United States. The rest are scattered around the world. But there's more Jews in Israel than any other location. But they're not all there. But you can see the partial fulfillment of the third Aliyah. They're coming back into the land, which God prophesied would happen. We'll dig into it in our next session together. I tell you this. Listen, you can study from Genesis 1:1 to Revelation 22:21. You'll never see another departure of the Jewish people or another return. There's only three departures and three returns. And we're in the midst of the last return of the Jewish people coming back into the land. Let me show you the principle that God has used over these many years. Go to Genesis chapter 9 just a moment. Genesis chapter 9, with this we'll conclude and take our break. Genesis chapter 9. Remember what I told you. Genesis 1 is creation. 2, the special effects of creation. 3, the fall of man. 4, the story of Cain and Abel. 5, a genealogy. 6, 7, and 8, Noah and the flood. Genesis 9, Noah after the flood. What does God tell Noah? Be fruitful, multiply with your sons and their wives and your wife, and repeople the earth. But then he does something else. He institutes human government. Chapter 9, verse 6. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. That's what we know as capital punishment. I don't debate capital punishment. There's no debate. It's an absolute. It's God's plan. It's God's institution. And within the confines of capital punishment, it's the epitome of human government. Human government was put together not to provide for the poor. That's the church's responsibility. Not to take care of the needy. That's the church's responsibility. Because we didn't do what we're supposed to do, government has interceded. But that doesn't give them the right. Government has two purposes: to protect from external attack and to protect from internal destruction. That's the only purpose of government. That was God's plan. And then to set the world stage for his prophecies to be fulfilled. And so, you know, God instituted three institutions: marriage, Genesis 2, human government, Genesis 9, and the local church, Acts chapter 2. And with those three institutions, you can win the world for Jesus Christ. That's the plan of God. But we've perverted almost every bit of it. But he's using human government. I just told you about Nebuchadnezzar. I told you about the Pharaoh in Egypt. I told you about how God is using human government. I talked to you about Vespasian, the emperor of Rome, and his son, General Titus. I talked about it. Go to Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17. Revelation 17 is the prophecy of the one world church that's going to be headquartered in the city of Rome. Not going into that at all. I just want to show you something very interesting here in Revelation chapter 17. Two verses and we'll close. Verse 16. And the ten horns, now prophetically that's talking about the revived Roman Empire. The ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, that phrase is used 42 times in Revelation, that's the Antichrist. These shall hate the whore, that's the false church, it's an apocalyptic term, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Verse 17, key verse in understanding what God's doing today. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will. God puts in the hearts of evil world leaders to fulfill his will. And that's what he's done down through history with the Jewish people. The three diasporas, the three returns, God's plan for preparing the Jewish people to ultimately give them all the promises and the blessings that they should receive. I like what David said. Mosaic covenant fulfilled. Because you know what it says in the first 14 chapters, verses of chapter 28 of the book of Deuteronomy? You obey me, I'm going to make you the number one nation of the world. I'm going to make you plenteous. I'm going to make you prosperous. Verse 16 and following in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, if you don't, chastisement's come. I'll scatter you to the four corners of the earth. That's what he's done. But he wants to fulfill that Mosaic covenant as he fulfills the Abrahamic covenant and the land covenant and the Davidic covenant and the new covenant and all of them within the new covenant. That's how God works. Thank you, Lord, for this time of studying your word and seeing how you, over these centuries, have worked in the hearts and lives of the Jewish people in preparation for accomplishing your ultimate goal. And you've even used world leaders, putting in their hearts to do what you want them to do to set the stage for these prophecies to be fulfilled. Thank you for this time. In Jesus' name, amen.